This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. More than half of the people who work with livestock in the U.S. are immigrants, and many of them speak Spanish. But that's not often the case for veterinarians.
If we're going to instruct people to do the right thing for the cows right now, we should probably do it in Spanish because workers feel more comfortable.
Vet schools across the country are opening the lines of communication with farm workers. We'll hear more about that.
And about a new study from Colorado State University that asked citizen scientists to mail in ticks to analyze where disease-bearing tick species are found.
Did people really put ticks in the mail?
They did, in the mail. About 16,000 of them, in fact.
16,000 ticks? Yuck.
I wouldn't want to sign for that package. And if ticks weren't bad enough, there's another kind of infestation taking hold right now across the West and in Colorado.
We've got people crouching in the tall grass, moving around almost on hands and knees, and they're carrying huge knives.
It's a war against an invasive plant that aggressively sucks up water. But is the tamarisk really the enemy? We'll find out more.
Plus, our film critic Howie Mofshevitz reviews The Cake Maker.
Now I want cake.
Me too.
But first, more than 4 million people visit Rocky Mountain National Park each year. The crowds are getting so big that many people are now looking for other parks and areas to visit in Colorado.
KUNC's Michael DeIuana has been looking at the numbers. He sat down to talk about it with Kyra Buckley.
Before we get into the data, will you humor me for a minute?
All right.
Last Wednesday, July 18th, was World Listening Day.
All right, I totally missed that.
Well, I bring it up because Rocky Mountain National Park was totally into it. On that day, they put out a press release to draw attention to their extensive catalog of natural soundscapes. That's the sound of coyotes howling amid red-winged blackbirds.
Wow, you can really hear those animals.
Yeah, these sounds were collected by Jacob Job, a researcher with Colorado State University and the Natural Sounds and Night Skies Division of the National Park Service. I also recorded sounds of the park when I was there a few weeks ago.
Okay, I think I can hear some birds in there.
Yeah, it's not the best recording, but that rumble, that's the sound of cars. And then this happened. And then this. That's my cell phone.
How annoying. Can I just suggest that maybe next time you turn that off the next time you're in nature?
Yeah, well, okay. In my defense, I was working, and in all fairness to the park, my nature recording was done close to the park's busy eastern entrance. But it makes my point. There's a lot of people moving around the park, and it's hard to get away from them. And that's why other parks are seeing their visitation numbers go up.
Such as?
Ever hear of Hovenweep National Monument?
Nope.
Well, it's way off the beaten path on the Colorado-Utah border. There's been an almost 7% rise in visits there during the first 6 months of this year compared to the same time last year. Now, you may be more familiar with Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park.
That one I've heard of.
There's been a 55% increase there.
As parks were getting busier, with many people setting out on trips for the summer to go visit new and unexplored places for them, places were starting to get full, and it was getting hard to get reservations in the well-known places.
Brant Porter is a supervisory ranger at Black Canyon. He said lesser-known areas like his, which is some 260 miles from Denver, are getting discovered because people are trying to avoid crowds at the more popular parks, and that creates challenges for him.
With more visitation comes things like full parking lots. And with that, trying to manage visitation and be true to being a steward of the resource with things like managing use in congressionally designated wilderness, which is what the inner canyon of Black Canyon is.
That means people who want to explore the area need to now make reservations weeks, even months in advance, especially during peak times.
What about other parks?
Visits to Dinosaur National Monument, which is about 110 miles north of Grand Junction, are up nearly 8%. Florissant Fossil Beds National Monument, 30 miles west of Colorado Springs, had 30% more visitors. Even Old Bent's Fort and the Sand Creek Massacre historic sites on the Eastern Plains are seeing more people.
And can we point to any factors that are driving this trend?
You actually answered your own question. cars.
Okay.
Cars are driving a lot of this. A record number of Coloradans took trips over the recent 4th of July holiday, according to AAA Colorado spokesman Skylar McKinley.
Colorado's population is also, it's no surprise to anybody, exploding. And it's not just Denver. It's all along the Front Range, as well as some more far-flung communities. But if you look at the profile of people who are moving here, in broad strokes, they're active. They're generally car owners. They appreciate and have moved to the West because of this bounty of things to see. And so I think you're having more new Colorado residents who are trying to see their new home.
Consumer confidence is fairly solid, too, and that helps get people to part with some of their hard-earned money, fill up the gas tank, and splurge on a trip. Which brings us back to this. That's the hermit thrush singing on the Gem Lake Trail at Rocky Mountain National Park.
That was KUNC's Michael DeIoanna talking with Kyra Buckley.
Now, no matter where you go in nature, you're sure to come back with some incredible photos. One thing you don't want to come home with, though, is a tick.
Definitely not.
No, they are freaky and gross.
A new study out of Colorado State University shows that disease-bearing ticks are more widespread than we knew. But the Mountain West is still relatively safe.
The study analyzed more than 16,000 ticks, most of them mailed in by citizen scientists from across 49 states and Puerto Rico. Disease-bearing tick species were discovered in scores of counties where they hadn't been found before. Greg Ebel specializes in tick-borne and infectious diseases at CSU.
One of the reasons that it's important to keep doing this kind of study is that the distribution of ticks and the pathogens that they transmit is changing really quickly.
Now, Ebel says parts of the U.S. are becoming more tick-friendly. That is partly due to the way human migration has changed the landscape and also to our changing climate. And some areas are worse off than others.
The bright side for those of us living in the Mountain West, again confirmed by this study, is that we're not really in a hotbed of tick-borne infections.
But he says that could change as more people move into our region and urban development continues.
About half of the people who work with livestock in the U.S. are immigrants, and many speak Spanish. That's not the case for the veterinarians guiding the farm workers. As KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, there's a push in vet schools to open those lines of communication.
Dairy worker Esperanza Yanez examines a heifer with a stethoscope. With one hand on the animal's underbelly, she leans in for a close listen. Over the years, she's learned to spot a sick cow. She says she sees signs that most people don't notice. She works with a veterinarian on a regular basis, following complex instructions for medication and diet. But the medical terminology can be confusing, especially if English is your second language. Since coming to the U.S. 2 decades ago, Yanez has taken English classes and practices by watching game shows like Jeopardy.
Oh, La Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. Okay.
Still, she'd feel more confident working with a vet who speaks Spanish. And many of her coworkers haven't been in the country as long as she has. To avoid embarrassment, she says they'll say they understand the English instructions, but when the vet walks away, that is, everyone's standing around asking each other, what did they say? The language barriers at this Colorado dairy are common on animal farms across the country. The most recent numbers from 2015 show that more than half of workers in the U.S. dairy and meat processing industries are immigrants, and many are Spanish-speaking.
We graduate from vet school as experts of reading the animal, but very little attention is paid to reading the people who are taking care of those animals, right, and trying to communicate with them effectively.
Noah Roman Muniz is a veterinarian and associate professor at Colorado State University. She grew up in Puerto Rico and noticed a language gap while interning on a dairy farm in Colorado. To get a leg up in the job market, she thinks all veterinary students should learn Spanish.
The reality is that if we're going to give training, if we're going to instruct people to do the right thing for the cows, right now, we should probably do it in Spanish because workers feel more comfortable.
Veterinary schools across the country have noticed the need. Purdue has a Spanish podcast for vet students. Kansas State and Texas A&M have a class called Spanish for Animal Health. Roman Muniz worked with CSU graduate student Shannon Zeller to design a course that streamlines Spanish by teaching students the verbs and vocabulary they need for working in the field. For example, explaining vaccinations or vacunas and describing a horse that's colicky or colico. Eventually, Zeller wants to design programs for professionals who work with construction workers, out in the field with migrant farm workers, and in hospitality.
But we have so much Spanish-speaking culture within our borders that I think language departments are becoming more aware of meeting the needs.
At La Luna Dairy, workers line up the cows in the milking parlor. Workers don't just carry out a vet's instructions. Yanez says because of their experience and the time they spend with the animals, they can help determine an animal's diagnosis. Of course, she says, they have to be able to communicate that. For Yanez, learning English took about 32 years and was born out of necessity. She's worked on farms where the managers spoke no Spanish. She thinks other workers should learn English, too. It helps the farm run smoother. Of course, there are barriers, like the cost of classes, low education levels among workers, and the long hours they spend on the farm. After a long day at work, says Yanez, you just want to go home and rest. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Well, there is much more coming up in this episode, including Howie's review of the cake maker. I can tell you it's already making me crave something delicious.
Me too. Plus, one of Denver's poorest neighborhoods is getting a major redesign.
Probably 5 years from now, maybe 10. It's not even going to look the same. It's going to be known in a good way, not a negative thing anymore. Positive, prosperous.
We'll find out how that neighborhood is finding a new focus when art comes to town. But before we get to that, it might seem lately like we're on the verge of some kind of war with everyone, like trade wars with China or Canada.
Right now, I feel like I'm at war with my dessert cravings.
Me too. But besides that personal internal war, we're also waging a war here at home with a plant. The tamarisk, or salt cedar, is taking over waterways in the West, and it's crowding out native species like cottonwoods. And Americans are fighting back. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle has more.
We've got people crouching in the tall grass, moving around almost on hands and knees, and they're carrying huge knives.
Two more.
The knives are called hori hori, a Japanese tool made specifically for gutting weeds. Others are carrying gardening shears.
So you got a full-on saw.
Yes, the tool of destruction.
But the enemy far outnumbers them. We're in a hot field in Longmont, Colorado, at a volunteer weeding event that's been going on for a few years now. Some people come every year.
It's going to be a few more years before we can kind of give up on this because they're sneaky.
The enemy is the tamarisk, a small tree with a prehistoric look to it, tall, with scaly leaves and tiny pink flowers. They look delicate, but the kind of delicate that makes them indestructible. Like if they got stepped on by a dinosaur, they might just bounce right back up again. It reminds one volunteer of a magical plant in Harry Potter.
You grasp your mandrake firmly, you pull it sharply out of the pot.
That's what I keep picturing every time I pull one.
People hate the tamarisk. It was brought to the U.S. in the late 1800s for erosion control and also decoration. But as the story goes, the tamarisk has been colonizing waterways, hogging water from other plants, and even salting the earth ever since, choking out native species like cottonwood trees and willows. There are weeding projects like this one going on all over the West. Across the mountains, there's even a state lab that's breeding beetles whose sole purpose is to assassinate tamarisk.
This is a war.
That's Matt Chu. He's a historian of invasion biology at Arizona State University. And he thinks this war is aimed at the wrong enemy.
There's been a concerted effort to demonize tamarisk.
Starting, he says, back in the 1930s. A company called Phelps Dodge wanted to expand a copper mine in Arizona, but didn't have enough water rights. All the local water rights had already been allocated.
What they needed was an excuse to say there was more water in the river so that Phelps Dodge could have more water.
Chu says when they looked at the nearby river, they saw lots of tamarisk. if we can convince people that the plants are sucking water out of the river, they thought, then they could kill the tamarisk and the mine could get the rights to that extra water.
Well, Phelps Dodge did a bunch of experiments, which were later picked up by the Agriculture Department.
And the mine ended up getting its water rights another way. But it didn't matter for the tamarisk. Its image was already destroyed. To make matters worse, something big was changing. The way that water was being moved through the West. Anna Scher is an invasive species biologist at the University of Denver.
In order to accommodate many human needs, we have dammed and channelized our rivers.
Which means they're flowing and flooding in ways that are good for the tamarisk, not so good for native plants. Scher agrees with Chu. The tamarisk isn't all bad. In recent years, researchers showed that tamarisk actually uses up the same amount of water as other river plants, including cottonwoods. And it turns out it also provides a good nesting spot for certain birds.
I certainly do not hate this plant, and I believe that it's only behaving badly because of the way that we've managed our rivers.
But that, she says, is not going to change anytime soon. So instead of addressing limited water, which is the root of the war, we're stuck fighting battles with the tamarisk, plant by plant.
It's a new game now with tamaricks here and with the water needs that we have now.
But though the trees might be fire-resistant and drought-resistant and able to reproduce like bunnies, Scher says those battles aren't totally futile. Her research has found that clearing out tamarisk can make space for native species to regrow. You just have to stay zen about what native plants might come back. They might be drought-adapted shrubs and grasses, not shady cottonwoods. And they will most certainly have a tamarisk or two as neighbors. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West News Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration. A lot of people may have been in Denver's Sun Valley neighborhood and not even realized it.
I don't even know where that is, and I've lived in Colorado my entire life.
Well, it's situated near the home of the Denver Broncos, and it's one of the poorest areas in the city. But in a few years, more than $1 billion will be invested into the neighborhood, transforming it into an arts and entertainment hub. KUNC Stacey Nick has more.
In the middle of Sun Valley is Rudy Park. It's where I meet Lisa Sines. Sitting on a park bench, she says she's excited for what lies ahead.
Probably 5 years from now, maybe 10. It's not even going to look the same. It's going to be known in a good way, not a negative thing anymore. Positive, prosperous.
That's a stark contrast to the way she felt about the neighborhood when she moved here 8 years ago. The area was riddled with crime, and Sines, a single mother of two, was escaping a violent marriage and homelessness.
I hid in my house and let the kids outside. Then I just kind of got tired of what I was seeing and kind of just started getting involved in going to meetings and making phone calls, helping out my neighbors.
Now she sees a bounty of new businesses, homes, and cultural organizations moving in. What she's happy not to see? Longtime businesses and residents being pushed out. Less than half a mile away, underneath the I-70 viaduct, is a row of pastel buildings along Lower Colfax Avenue. It's the former headquarters of Ready Foods.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Nice to meet you. Come on in.
Nice to meet you.
I have to excuse the informality. I have a lot going on today.
Adriana Abarca's family started the food processing company in 1972. She has fond memories of those days.
Driving over the viaduct as a kid and on the way home from downtown and seeing the old Star Bread sign lit up was always very exciting to me. And this was our neighborhood.
10 years ago, she and her late father, Luis, began storing the family's ever-growing Mexican art collection in the office. Now she's building the Latino Cultural Arts Center.
This section is dedicated to folk art for various parts of Mexico. I knew that I would have to create a museum specifically for the Abarca family collection because if I were to donate it to other institutions, most of it would end up in permanent storage. It would rarely see the light of day.
Phase one of the $12 million project also includes a 100-seat black box theater, a restaurant, and a store selling works from local artists. It's slated to open in 2020.
Thank you guys all for coming.
Also opening in 2020.
I'm Vince Kedlubek. I'm the CEO, co-founder of Meow Wolf.
During a press conference in January, the Santa Fe-based arts collective announced it was expanding to Colorado, specifically on the outskirts of Sun Valley.
Hopefully we can create some jobs and we can generate some profit, and that profit can go right back into the creative communities of Denver, because that's where our heart is. That's our social mission. That's what we care about.
The four-story, 90,000-square-foot permanent exhibition is expected to attract 1.5 million visitors each year. Another large-scale project that could transform the area is the Stadium District Master Plan. The proposed mixed-use neighborhood would occupy the south end of the stadium's property. Right now, the sea of parking lots is only used during games and special events. The nonprofit venture between the Metropolitan Football Stadium District and the Denver Broncos Football Club just held their first public meeting on the plan. Adriana Abarca attended that meeting, but is still a little hesitant. She says Sun Valley needs revitalization, not gentrification.
The vast majority of the development in Denver is very white-centric, and I find that very disturbing. So I would hope that they want to integrate other communities into their efforts.
That also weighed heavily on the minds of the Sun Valley Community Coalition and the Denver Housing Authority 5 years ago.
We have been strategically going through our larger and older family communities like Sun Valley Homes with an eye toward not just improving the housing that's there, but really transforming the neighborhood completely.
That's DHA Executive Director Ismael Guerrero. Beginning this year, all 333 units of Denver's oldest public housing neighborhood will be strategically replaced to ensure residents that want to stay can. DHA is also tripling the amount of area homes with additional workforce and market rate housing,
which just makes it a more viable, a more diverse, often a safer and more vibrant community.
Another part of that equation is the mix of businesses in the area.
It had a very spotty past.
Susan Powers is the president of Urban Ventures, which owns what is now Steam on the Platte. In the past, its location was an abandoned building where squatters included an illegal marijuana grow operation and a biker gang. Now, the mixed-use space has a variety of tenants, everything from the Denver headquarters for Lyft to a coffee shop run by Girls Inc. of Metro Denver as a way to teach girls entrepreneurial skills.
There are, you know, so many new businesses moving in and opportunities for jobs and for partnerships between the Meow Wolves and residents that are artists that happen to live in the neighborhood.
That's not something Denver is used to seeing. Powers, who is also working with the Latino Cultural Arts Center, points to widespread gentrification throughout the city, including the River North District, typically known as Rhino.
I'm not blaming folks in Rhino. I was an early developer there and would never have expected what's happened there. There's some really wonderful businesses and art there and all, but it happened so quickly. It doesn't seem quickly. You know, when you look at, well, it was over 5 or 10 years, but it was a pent-up demand, and you can't react and change that direction, and that's what's happening in a lot of neighborhoods in Denver. This one in particular just seems like it's more deliberate with a set of values underlying it, that we want this to be a neighborhood that is still embracing the folks that are here and what the history is that they bring.
Everything starts with a sketch. You have to plan stuff out.
That's Sun Valley artist Mary L. Lovejoy's philosophy anyway, not just in art, but in life. It's part of the reason she's working with Meow Wolf on a committee advising them about their new neighborhood.
To have a company come in and say, hi guys, this is us and we're moving to your neighborhood and we really want to be beneficial to your neighborhood. The fact that they did that is just extraordinary, and I think it puts them above the rest.
Specifically, she's helping them ensure that it's accessible to people in the neighborhood, especially children. More than half of Sun Valley's overall population is 15 or younger. But even with all the assurances of working together, Cassie Leakes still has her doubts. I met the 25-year-old mother of four at the neighborhood food bank, Glenn's Kitchen.
I like that there's lots of programs coming in so that our community has something that they can do, but I'm kind of nervous that they'll forget about the actual community because we're so diverse. There's so many different languages, and I hope that they cater to that.
Across the street back at Rudy Park, resident Lisa Sines, who is now a community connector with the DHA, says she's already seeing a new energy and optimism among residents who now want to stay. Block parties are the norm, she says, and neighbors talk to each other, With the help of a local graphic design shop, kids have even redesigned a Denver police car to pay tribute to the diversity of the Sun Valley neighborhood.
And I don't know if that happens everywhere, but I know this is something new that's happening now here. And I see, when I see the kids happy and their parents happy, that makes me happy. They're not scared to come outside anymore. They're out there living their life.
For KONC, I'm Stacey Nick.
You might expect the new Israeli film, The Cake Maker, to be a how-to baking documentary.
I kind of was hoping.
Me too. But it's actually a glimpse into a tangled relationship between an Israeli family man, his wife, and his male German lover. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says the resolution is unconventional and unexpected.
A man in a bakery cafe in Berlin sits in front of a gorgeous slice of Black Forest chocolate cake. He's Oren Roy Miller, an Israeli who works for a German-Israeli company. In close-up, Oren's fork moves slowly down through the cake to dislodge a bite-sized piece. It's a luscious slide through the layers of cream and chocolate, followed by another, and soon the face of the satisfied Oren. This must be the most wonderful piece of cake in the history of the movies. It's also key to the film. The cake maker's full of sensual close-ups, mostly of faces and awkward moments with hints of desire. The hands of Thomas the baker, Tim Kalkoff, are soft like his face. They handle the dough with sure, delectable motions, and you can watch the dough take shape and substance. The genius of The Cake Maker, the first feature from Israeli director Ofir Raul-Grazer, lives in his embrace of intimacy. His movie's unafraid of the feelings and the uncertainties of his characters. Oren likes the cookies and loves that cake, just as he's taken more than a shine to Thomas. Oren has a wife and son in Jerusalem, but he and Thomas fall in love. It's convenient for Oren to have two lives. There's no chance that Thomas and Oren's wife Anat, Sarah Adler, will bump into each other, he may think. Back in Jerusalem, Oren dies when he's hit by a car, which leaves Anat and Thomas separately devastated. In his grief, Thomas goes to Jerusalem, watches Anat as she opens a cafe, and gets her to hire him to wash dishes. Of course, he manages to bake something one morning, and because Anat has viable taste buds, she slowly lets Thomas do more and more baking. And the cafe draws more and more patrons, who love the cookies, the cakes, and the fruit tarts. Be prepared to be hungry. But there's more to the cake baker than the food. It's a complicated situation. You wonder if Thomas is some kind of creep. He's a quiet man. He expresses plenty through his baking, but mostly doesn't know what to say. Anat's trying to figure out her life as a single mother starting a business. Awkward silences dominate the film. They leave the kind of open spaces that make you wonder and speculate and consider. The only talker in the movie is Oren's brother Moti. He's a religious zealot who talks too much and pushes religion on Anat and her son. Anat's a secular woman, but in Jerusalem religion has a lot of clout. She needs a certificate that her cafe is kosher, and Moti, who has something to do with that, doesn't like the presence of her German non-Jewish baker because he's not Jewish and because he's German, which is still an issue. Anat and Thomas make their situation even dicier, as you might expect, because they start to notice each other in a hesitant way that goes beyond boss and baker. Anat then has to deal with the improprieties that Thomas is not Jewish and she's a widow and his employer. We in the theater, along with Thomas, know that he's gay. Anat does not. So how can all that resolve? Except for Moti, the cake maker isn't interested in villains, and he's not much of a villain. The picture shows people in circumstances that can be trying, but also sweet and gracious. The film's a vision of the struggle between custom, morality, ethics, personality, and the randomness of human desire. One thing missing, though, may be the complexities of Israeli society. Characters are all Jews of European background, no Moroccan, Yemeni, or African Jews, so no one of darker skin, and no Palestinians. Is this a comment on Israeli life, a blindness in the film? Or maybe a picture of how Israeli life in Jerusalem can be thoroughly segregated? I don't know. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Other music in this episode that we heard, Bloom Style from Robbie Reverb, As Colorful as Ever by Broke for Free, Flutterby by Poddington Bear, and Dr. Turtle with Grow Grotesque.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
You know that's right. Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.